for joining us. I'm Diane Rehm. It's Oscar season, and this year, critics agree the top contenders are not likely to be the big blockbuster films that drive audiences to theaters. Instead, movies like Manchester by the Sea, Arrival, and the new musical La La Land are leading the pack. Natalie Portman is creating lots of Best Actress Oscar buzz for her performance in Jackie, about the iconic First Lady. Here in the studio for a review of the season's best films, Anna Hornaday of The Washington Post, joining us from a studio in New York City, A.O. Scott of The New York Times, and by phone from Los Angeles, Kenneth Turan of The Los Angeles Times and NPR. I'm sure many of you have your own favorites. Give us a call. Tell us what they are and how you feel about them. Call us on 800-433-8850. Send an email to drshow@wamu.org. Follow us on Facebook or send us a tweet. And thank you all for joining us.
Hello, hello. Thank you for having me.
Great to be here.
Good to have you all. Anna Hornaday, this movie season is somewhat different, isn't it?
Well, it's a little bit subdued. I think we have gotten into a sort of competing business model in the movie business and movie culture, which is, on the one hand, sustained by this tentpole blockbuster special effects spectacle kind of movie that tends to open in the summer. And then in the fall, in the holiday season, we get quote-unquote awards movies, and those tend to be the adult dramas that are a little bit, less visual effects-driven, more narrative-driven, more character-driven. And I think we're seeing that exact same, and with the awards campaigns and the awards attention being the marketing hook for these films that allow the studios to keep making them.
Tony Scott, how much do you think the election season affected movies this year?
It's a very interesting question. I think that for a while, the election, just as the kind of while the campaign was going on, was a bigger show with more plot twists and comedy and horror and drama and spectacle than anything on the screens. I think what's interesting is that since the election, the movies have been doing pretty well. Whether people want to go to escape from the reality or find movies that in some way reflect or resonate with what's been going on, the movies seem kind of an important and valuable part of what we're doing in the wake of the election, and in ways that I think might be a little unexpected. I mean, there's a lot of talk, for example, about La La Land, which had a tremendous limited release opening. This is this musical with Ryan Gosling and Emma Stone, and it's been kind of maybe prematurely anointed an Oscar frontrunner because it's so escapist, because it just seems to be giving a kind of pleasure and delight and fantasy the way that movies did, back in the Depression, the way that Fred Astaire and Ginger Rogers, danced America through dark times.
And Ken Turan, to what extent really are people going to the movies these days? Is movie going up, down, or about the same?
I think it's about the same. One of the things that's interesting in this country is that we determine movie admission. We add all the numbers up and we say this was a $100 million movie or whatever. In France, for instance, they tally admissions and they tell you exactly how many people went. So it's easier to see whether, a country's movie going is going up or down. But my sense is that it's kind of probably holding okay, maybe trending down a little bit. I think recently some of the films that have been intended for teenage boys have not done as well as they have in the past, which caused a lot of tremors of fear in Hollywood. But I think people, if there is something that people want to see, people will go. I mean, it's just that simple. People
sure.
don't go as a habit anymore. There has to be something specific that drives them out.
I read somewhere that 53% of ticket sales in the U.S. are coming from millennials. And that's sort of in line with previous generations. And Hornaday, talk about some of the front runners. Moonlight, for example.
Oh, well, Moonlight is an absolutely astonishing film by a filmmaker named Barry Jenkins, who adapted a play by Terrell McCraney. And this was my top film of the year. I'm not alone by any stretch. Many of my colleagues put it on the tops of their list. It's already starting to win some of these early critics and award-giving organization awards. It's the story of a young man coming of age in Miami in impoverished circumstances, and it follows him through three distinct chapters of his life, during which he's played by three separate actors. And his best friend, who figures really prominently in his life, is also played by three separate actors. And so it's just structurally and formally a fascinating, elegant, simple, beautifully made piece of cinema with just fantastic acting and lush, poetic visuals, just extraordinary writing in terms of just revealing character through subtext and physical embodiment.
Are you saying that the three different characters embody three different ages?
Correct.
Okay.
Yes, it starts when he's a young boy and then a teenager and then a grown man.
All right. And let's hear a clip from Moonlight, as Anne Hornaday has said, written and directed by Barry Jenkins.
This one time, I run by this old lady. I was running, hollering, cutting a fool, boy. This old lady, she stopped me. She said, "Running around, catching a boy that light. In moonlight, black boys look blue. You blue. That's what I gonna call you. Blue.
Say your name, Blue."
Nah. At some point, you gotta decide for yourself who you gonna be. Can't let nobody make that decision for you.
Why is that such an important moment in the movie?
Well, that is the film's protagonist as a young little boy is sort of taken under the wing of a drug dealer in that scene played by Mahershala Ali in an extraordinary performance. An unlikely protector, a counterintuitive hero, but yet he does emerge as a hero of the film in terms of taking care of this young man. And in that pivotal scene we see, starting him on the road to kind of questioning his identity, accepting his identity, expressing his, you know, it's all about identity and selfhood, forging selfhood against these social forces that are kind of impinging. I don't want to give too much away.
Yeah,
you know,
of course not. Duran, what did you think of Moonlight?
Oh, I love Moonlight. I'm part of that group. You know, what I'm thinking as we're talking about it, one of the great things about this film is that it's very hard to say in words why it has this effect on you. It can tend to sound very schematic. It can tend to sound like something we've seen before. But when you see it, you feel like it's nothing you've ever seen before. There's a magical way all its elements interact that just make you connect with the emotion on screen in a way that you really feel differently. And, you know, people just have to take this on faith. This is, you know, if you're serious about film, you have to see this one.
Tony Scott, what did you think?
Well, this was my number one movie of the
wow.
10 best
wow.
list. I saw it in Telluride where it premiered, where Barry Jenkins, the filmmaker, has worked as a programmer and a member of the staff for a long time. And I had seen his first film. This is his second feature. His first, which came out, I think, 7 or 8 years ago, is called Medicine for Melancholy. It can be watched online now. It's a terrific kind of small scale romantic story about two people in San Francisco. Very different from Moonlight, but shows a kind of a sensitivity to character and a willingness to pay attention to quiet emotions. I mean, the thing about Moonlight that's so extraordinary in a way is how it's gripping, it's moving, but also how undramatic it is, how it doesn't turn on the usual beats of plot or of melodrama. So, yeah, you could say the story, well, it sounds very schematic. It's you know, a young, poor, gay African-American boy coming of age. You could imagine that story being told in a very kind of conventional and predictable way. This one is told in a way from within, from inside this person's experience, and with a great attention to quiet. The ending of this movie, not to spoil it, is one of the quietest endings of a movie, I think, that I've perhaps ever seen. And it's so moving and so exquisite, and it takes you right into the characters' lives in a way that few films do.
A.O. Tony Scott. He's chief film critic for the New York Times. Here in the studio, Anne Hornaday, movie critic for the Washington Post, and Kenneth Turan, film critic for the Los Angeles Times and NPR's Morning Edition.
DCS Daily.
DCS Daily.
DCS Daily.
It's news,
culture, and curiosities.
From the District, Tacoma Park,
Alexandria,
Friendship Heights,
Hyattsville,
Falls Church,
Northeast Washington, D.C., in your inbox every weekday afternoon.
DCS Daily.
Sign up at dcs.com/newsletter.
dcs.com/newsletter.
And welcome back. We're talking about one of my favorite subjects in this hour, movies. How I love them. They are my primary form of entertainment. But I'm so sad to tell you, I've seen one movie this year, and it was last year's movie. It was Brooklyn.
Oh,
and I love Brooklyn.
Wonderful.
It was a fabulous movie. Tell me about your thoughts on La La Land.
Oh, well, La La Land is irresistible. It's, as Tony said, it's by this filmmaker named Damien Chazelle, who really got on the map a few years ago with a movie called Whiplash, which I know a lot of your listeners will recognize, about the jazz drumming student coming under the tutelage of a martinet played by J.K. Simmons. And in this film, he revisits the old MGM and Jacques Demy musicals of yore, just delivering this incredibly escapist parable, allegory of these two young people falling in love in Los Angeles, both of them striving to have careers in show business. And so it's really about art and ideals and compromise. And I think the wonderful subtext, you know, in addition to just being visually lush and full of great music and dancing and romance and fun and escapism, there is a real sort of poignant subtext there, I think, where he's looking at film as an art form and in terms of where it's going. It's both in terms of its past, its future, the changes that it's undergoing, both as a culture and also in an industry. So there's layers to it that I think give it a lot more content and subtext than
you know. I grew up, Tony Scott, in the era of all the musicals and used to go and see them with my mother. So having La La Land come out now, again, one wonders, totally escapist, totally entertaining, totally different from everything we're all seeing and feeling.
Yeah, and I mean, it's fascinating because it's as Anne says, it's a throwback to those old kind of movie musicals that used to be just a kind of a part of the regular diet of moviegoers. But it doesn't feel entirely nostalgic. There's some nostalgia certainly woven into it, but it's about the characters are living today. They're modern young people. They're millennials, and I think there's a kind of an attempt to to see if, and it's a bit of a gamble, to see if young people, you know, who grew up watching Glee, who, you know, have memorized the Hamilton soundtrack and the Book of Mormon soundtrack. I mean, there's a lot of great musical theater and a revival of interest in musical theater out there in the world. And Chazelle is in a way saying, well, let's try to do this with movies again. This is something that movies can do that no other form can quite do, create this sort of fantasy. The last 20 minutes of this movie, I think, are just a kind of a tour de force of emotion and dance. There's a ballet in there, like the American in Paris ballet. There's stuff that you really haven't seen a filmmaker try to do in a very long time. For me, at least, it just works. It works beautifully.
Kenneth Turan, I was surprised to see Ryan Gosling in this movie. How does he do?
Well, he's a wonderful actor. It's always a treat to see him, and I think he does very, very well. You know, it's interesting with these films. You know, I think it kind of reminds me almost of Westerns. These tastes endure in audiences. It's just sometimes the films aren't good enough to call the audiences out. You know, and I think people forgot about musicals for many, many years, or their attempts were inept. And this one is very beautifully done, and I hope it resonates. I think it will.
Let's hear a clip.
City of stars, are you shining just for me? City of stars, there's so much that I can't see. Something wonderful new, or one more dream that I cannot make true.
Of course, that was Ryan Gosling singing. I remember him from The Notebook.
Exactly.
So that's why I was so surprised that he'd be in this musical. He has a lovely voice.
It's kind of got that wonderful Chet Baker softness to it.
Yeah.
Not perfect by any stretch, but that's part of the charm of this. I mean, I don't think either of them are necessary. Although, you know, let's remember Ryan Gosling got his start as I think he was a Musketeer, if I'm not mistaken. So he's a hoofer. He's
How
an old song
that?
And dance kid
How
from way back.
That?
So, but the film leans in. I mean, first of all, both Emma Stone and Ryan Gosling have such great chemistry. And the choreography, the music, it all kind of, it forgives whatever weaknesses they might have as singers and dancers, and just it melds beautifully with their particular gifts. And as you heard there's a real poignant note to it, too. I mean, this isn't all,
happiness and shuffling feet. Ken Turan, talk a little about Manchester by the Sea. A caller who couldn't stay on, Gloria from Bethesda, said Moonlight and Manchester by the Sea were great. However, no one talks about how depressing they are. Was Manchester by the Sea depressing for you?
Well, yes and no. I mean, one of the things about Manchester by the Sea is that even though they're bleak things that are detailed, there's a real sense of humor in this film. I mean, this is a film, this is Kenneth Lonergan, who did You Can Count on Me several years ago. Kenneth Lonergan is kind of, I don't know, he's a poet of the human condition. He really understands how people feel, how people talk. This thing is very, very real. It almost makes you understand how far from reality so many of the films we see are. It's a story of a young man played by Casey Affleck, not so young, who is living in the Boston area and is called back to the town he grew up in and has to become the guardian of his nephew. And he does not want to move back to the town he grew up in. And the story just pulls you in. The acting is spectacular. I mean, I was, you know, for me, if something really is superbly done, I don't feel depressed by it. I'm exhilarated by something that really hits me so deeply. And again, as I say, not only that, but there is real humor here. There's intentional humor here. There's the humor. Anyone who's laughed at a joke in a horrible situation will understand the humor in this film. And it's just, it's a spectacular thing to see. And I have split it with Moonlight for my best pick of the year. I have been in a Solomon-like way divided the choice.
Tony Scott, forgiveness is a big deal in this movie.
It is. I mean, I have to say I admire many of the things that Kenny does about this movie and that our other colleagues do. I'm not quite as in love with Manchester by the Sea as a lot of other critics. I mean, I think that the writing is superb. The acting is superb. I have some problems with the story, actually. I mean, I think that there is a kind of melodramatic inflation of emotion. There's something that happens that I won't say, or that is revealed to have happened, that explains the state that the Casey Affleck character is in. I couldn't write about this in my review because it would have been a huge spoiler. But that I objected to and tend to object to when things like this happen in a story. So it was flawed for me, but I do think that the theme of how you overcome a tragedy, how you deal with your own sense of guilt, how and whether you can forgive yourself, is very present and very interestingly explored in this movie, and really is the center of Casey Affleck's performance. He's a guy who cannot let himself off the hook, cannot move on, is almost choosing to remain stuck in this tragic, kind of miserable, self-flagellating situation.
It's interesting, and Hornaday, lots of people, when this movie came out, talked about Casey Affleck as a shoe-in for Manchester by the Sea. And yet, there's been some new information that's come out about his behavior, his personal behavior, stuff about sexual harassment, all kinds of things. Mm. What is that all about?
Well, I'm not very well read on it myself, so I'll warn you. I mean, there were accusations from female colleagues, this is several years ago now, that he ended up settling. I think they came to a settlement out of court, so I don't think it ever reached, a civil or criminal court case. But as things do, especially with award season coming up, a lot of this stuff does resurface. And whether or not, I don't know how it will sort of cycle through at this point, since it has been sort of dealt with and I think completed.
But. All right, let's hear a clip from Manchester by the Sea.
I don't understand.
Which part are you having trouble with?
Well, I can't be his guardian.
Well,
I mean, I can't.
Well, naturally, I assumed Joe had discussed all this with you.
No. He didn't. No.
So I have to say I'm somewhat taken aback.
He can't live with me. I live in one room.
Well, but Joe has provided for Patrick's upkeep. Food, clothes, etc. And the house and the boat are owned outright.
I can't commute from Boston every day until he turns 18.
I think the idea was that you would relocate.
Relocate to where?
Well, as you can see, you know, your brother worked everything out extremely carefully.
He can't have meant that.
Kind of a shocker. You know, to have something like that thrust on.
And, you know, it's when Tony was describing Moonlight, it reminded me of the way I describe Manchester, which is that it's interstitial. I mean, Lonergan has this way of getting to those moments in between the moments that most filmmakers focus on. So you have these, there's a scene early in the film where Casey Affleck's character shows up at a hospital, and there's just this real-time scene in a hospital corridor. And, you know, as Kenny Lonergan said when I interviewed him, we've all been in that hallway at some point. And he stays there. And where most conventional films would cut or do a montage or, you know, they'd try to elide it in some way, he just stays right in those moments.
And you're listening to The Diane Rehm Show. We've got a number of callers who'd like to be part of the program. Let's go to Marianne in Shreveport, Louisiana. You're on the air.
Hello. Hi, Diane. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I may have missed it. I was off for just a minute, but I saw Moonlight and Loving back-to-back, and I thought Loving was exceptional. The acting, the portrayal of a true story, an important story, and I would like to hear your guest's opinion of that.
And that's a story about legalizing interracial marriage, is it not?
Yes, it's the historic Richard and Mildred Loving case that was decided by the wonderfully, they just happened to have that last name. And that is now the Supreme Court case that went down in history.
All right, let's hear a clip.
You go to the Virginia State Court next, right?
Yes.
You nervous?
I suppose. The lawyers told us not to expect much.
You think you'll lose?
Well, yes. But I think it's all right. We may lose the small battles, but win the big war.
Tony Scott, what do you think of Loving?
Well, it's beautifully understated. The thing that's Ruth Negga, an Irish actress, as Mildred Loving, and Joel Edgerton plays her husband Richard. And the thing that the movie, which directed by Jeff Nichols, who had two movies come out this year, the other one was Midnight Special. The thing that that he's really good at, again, this is sort of the theme of our conversations, is getting into the detail and the fine grain of people's lives. So this is a kind of movie, it's about a court battle against injustice, and you kind of expect that it's building toward one of these kind of big emotional scenes where the characters, or one of the characters or the two of them, are going to stand up and kind of explain the movie to you, sort of emote everything that this movie is about. And that scene never happens. They stay within. They're quiet, modest. They're people from a rural part of Virginia, childhood sweethearts. They've grown up together. They don't really seek to become symbols or activists or rebels. They just want to live their lives. They actually, when their marriage is declared illegal by the state of Virginia, they just move away. They move to Washington, and then family circumstances kind of call them back, and they pursue this case. And because you just feel the quiet reality of their lives and their love for each other, the irrationality and the monstrosity of this system that says these two people can't be married hits you with much more force and much more specificity than if you had kind of big dramatic courtroom scenes and tearful outbursts. So it's really the understatement of this movie that I think makes it work so beautifully.
Agreed on every point. I think for Jeff Nichols to take that tack is an incredibly bold, almost subversive choice in resisting all of those temptations for the big courtroom scene and like Tony said, the speeches. I mean, it's almost transgressively quiet and intimate and all the more powerful for it.
And you'll be interested to know from an email from Anna, the editors in our Indiana town are a monopoly. We don't see the films you're describing. 12 theaters over 3 complexes show the same big blockbuster film. They won't bring Loving or any artful smaller film for us to see. And in Mississippi, it is not being shown. Mm. Short break, right back. And welcome back. I want to go back for a moment to Manchester by the Sea because, Tony Scott, you said this is a movie, quote, about the sorrows of white men. Explain what you meant by that.
Well, I think that there's a tendency post-election to look at a lot of different movies and things in popular culture and look for, you know, either explanations or some kind of information. It struck me as I was watching this movie both times that I saw it that it's not just incidentally a movie in which the characters are all white. And I think that we need as critics to stop thinking of sort of the whiteness of characters in movies as just a default category. You know, it's very easy for us to say, well, Moonlight is a movie about African-American characters. You know, Loving is certainly a movie about race. Fences, which is coming up with Viola Davis and Denzel Washington, that's a movie about the African-American experience. But we tend to sort of take everything else as kind of by default universal without thinking about the specificity of the characters and their circumstances. And it seems to me that this movie, like many movies that are set in Massachusetts, is about the kind of the suffering of white, lower middle class and working class mm-hmm. characters. And I think it's one of the things that is a kind of subtext for this movie is very much the sense of disaffection, of alienation, of frustration, of woundedness, perhaps of resentment that, you know, political writers and journalists have been telling us played out in the election of Donald Trump. So I think that this movie is not an overtly political movie in any way. But I do think that it has a kind of an undercurrent that interestingly connects with some of the things that are going on in our politics.
All right. Now, I want to move on. Kenneth Turan, tell me your thoughts about the film Jackie.
Well, I was very excited to see Jackie. I was at Venice at the world premiere, and it was a very exciting moment. You know, this is a story we think we know. This is the story of Jackie Kennedy, the days after the assassination. But Pablo Larraín, who is a Chilean director who actually has another film coming out called Neruda, has been, you know, for film buffs, he's really a name that we know. His films have been in festivals, and we are fans of his. But this is kind of a step forward for him. This is his first English-language film. This is a film on a big topic. And I was just really totally fascinated by how he made this story his own, how he made it edgy, how he made it unusual, unexpected. Wonderful performance by Natalie Portman as Jackie Kennedy. It just really gripped me. I couldn't wait to see what was going to happen in the next frame. I just was very taken with this film.
I gather Natalie Portman and Hornaday does a fantastic job, especially with that breathy voice.
Indeed, that voice. I mean, she's really mastered that, and I think it really comes through. This is another sort of structural triumph, in my opinion, because it takes place during the days immediately after the assassination of John F. Kennedy, when she's planning the funeral, and then a week later when she gives that pivotal interview to Life magazine, when she first floated the whole Camelot myth and brilliantly solidified his legacy in both of those actions. And Larraín, in his brilliance, has juxtaposed those events with the White House tour that she gave in 1962, which we, you know, so many of us remember,
oh,
that prim
absolutely.
Figure, you know, balletically making her way through that White House. And those are the sequences that where Portman's performance really struck me as
why
just being...
Why is the movie R-rated?
Well, I think there's just a little tiny bit of profanity, but Lorraine is very graphic in terms of the events in Dallas. I mean, and I think it's not gratuitous at all because, I mean, he gets us so far into her psyche, into her vulnerability, her fear, her anger, and her brilliance in terms of understanding history and symbolism and material culture and ritual and what the American people needed and what she needed to solidify Kennedy's legacy. I mean, it's really about myth-making. And in showing us how she made the Camelot myth, it kind of addresses her own myth in a way that I found was very compassionate. I mean, it's not a negative portrayal in any way. It's very humanizing.
Tony?
I think another reason for the rating might be the fact that she smokes about three packs of cigarettes on screen in the course of
Never not smoking.
Really?
She's never not smoking.
And never saw her smoking.
Right. That's right. And I mean, for me, it was fascinating because I realized, and I think this is part of what the movie is doing, is that it, as Kenny said, we think we know the story, but she remains a very enigmatic figure. I realized when I was listening to Natalie Portman's amazing, you know, the precision of her vocal performance, that you've heard Jack Kennedy's voice. You know, that I can summon into my head, and that's been impersonated, you know, dozens and dozens of times. But I realized that I didn't really know. I didn't have a preconceived kind of sound in my head of Jacqueline, and I had only really, you know, known her from the photographs of her in the pink suit and of her with the widow's veil as the cortege went by. So this really just kind of takes us in a very startling way from these public events that are among the best known public events in post-war American history, and goes into not only behind closed doors, but kind of into the mind and the emotions and the personality of a key player in them who we maybe didn't recognize. It's also partly about her understanding her own political role and wielding the power that she has, which is a very limited and specific kind of power within the White House, dominated by these guys, Bobby Kennedy and the Johnsons and Jack Valenti and so on.
Until
she figures out how to outfox them.
Exactly. All right, let's go to Laurie in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. You're on the air.
Hi, Diane. I will miss you. I love your show with its blend of politics and arts.
Thank you.
Last year I saw Spotlight, like in October, and I knew then I'd seen the best movie of the year. And this year I'm not so sure although there's so many things I haven't seen yet because I live in Pittsburgh, we get stuff late, so Hidden Figures isn't here, Moonlight's not here, Loving's not here, Manchester by the Sea is across town, and Rogue One, which is not really opera, but I mean Oscar caliber, but I'm looking forward to it, opens up on Thursday. But my favorite movie this year has been Arrival. Because it's a smart science fiction movie, it's quiet, it's not bombastic, and it has a wonderful Amy Adams performance.
Let's hear a bit of Arrival.
Everything you're doing there, I have to explain to a room full of men whose first and last question is how can this be used against us?
Kangaroo.
What is that?
In 1770... Captain James Cook's ship ran aground off the coast of Australia, and he led a party into the country, and they met the Aboriginal people. One of the sailors pointed at the animals that hop around and put their babies in their pouch, and he asked what they were, and the Aborigines said, kangaroo. It wasn't until later that they learned that kangaroo means, I don't understand.
I can sell that for now.
Yeah.
And remember what happened to the Aborigines? A more advanced race nearly wiped them out.
It's a good story.
Thanks. It's not true. But it proves my point.
So we should explain what Arrival is all about.
It's wonderful. It's an adaptation of a I don't know if it's a novel or a short story now, about these mysterious spacecraft that appear hovering over the Earth at 12 different points around the globe. And the U.S. military, embodied there by Forrest Whitaker, brings in a linguist played by Amy Adams to try to encounter these, the beings that are inside these spacecraft, to try to figure out what they want and see if she can establish some kind of communication with them. And what's so interesting, you know, to circle back to your early question about the election, Arrival opened the Friday after the election, and I remember being very interested in seeing whether people would go. I mean, you know, were people so shell-shocked and sort of numb? And but they did. I mean, Arrival has actually become a really big success. It's done very well, and it did it particularly well that weekend. And its themes of communication and trying to break down paranoia about aliens and immigration, I mean, there are all these sort of subtexts to it that I think made it a very interesting film in the immediate aftermath of the election.
All right. I want to go back one moment because we've heard from several listeners who've said that Loving is being shown in Mississippi. It's being shown in Tupelo and Madison theaters at least, and in Jackson as well. So I'm glad we're correcting that. And I want to hear a clip from Jackie. I want to hear that voice.
I've come to discuss tomorrow.
The Attorney General relayed to me your desire for a more modest ceremony.
I've changed my mind.
I'm sorry?
I said I've changed my mind. We will have a procession, and I will walk to the cathedral with the casket.
Well, even if we could resume the arrangements, I'm sure you can understand the Secret Service still has their concerns.
I'm President Johnson.
President Johnson would like nothing more than to fulfill your wishes, but I have to take into account his safety. The country couldn't endure another blow should any... It's not to say. If it were up to him, he would do anything that might bring you comfort.
Then who is it up to, Mr. Valenti?
Well, as I'm sure you know, tomorrow we're expecting close to 100 heads of state.
103.
And you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. Pretty powerful moment in that.
Very. And very crafty. And it gets exactly to what Tony was saying about her wielding.
Right.
And I think in addition to the White House and the incoming Johnson administration, she's battling the Kennedy family. I mean, you know, she was, and that has its roots in, you know, they did sort of see her as a prop, and they kind of dismissed her and underestimated her. And this is a woman really coming into her own. And part of the kind of drama for the audience is that we do know what she became, you know, but she doesn't know at that point. She's a young widow, the young mother of these two tiny children. And she's just so, you really experience firsthand her vulnerability and her not being sure what will become of her.
And yet to be able to show this power and authority to demonstrate this will that she has to conduct this funeral in her own way. Tony, talk a little about O.J. Made in America.
Well, O.J. Made in America was, for one thing, a great gift to film critics, because it was made for ESPN, but it was released theatrically. It's a multi-part, I think, a total of 6 hours, I believe, documentary directed by Ezra Edelman about not just about the O.J. trial, which we saw on TV, but about the whole career of O.J. Simpson before and after the murders of Nicole Brown Simpson and Ronald Goldman. And it's also about sports. It's about race. It's about the relationship between the police and the African-American community in Los Angeles. It's about celebrity. It's kind of like a great American novel, but a true story brought to the screen. Because it was released the way it was and is eligible for the Oscars, we got to write about it instead of our TV critic colleagues, which was a great victory.
Yeah. Kenneth Turan, what'd you make of it?
Oh, I was entranced by it. I mean, I think it is actually not six, it's 7.5 hours long. And long as
six
it is
parts,
when
right.
when it ended, I wanted more. I didn't say, oh, thank God, it's finished. I wanted more. The interviews are spectacular. You know, this is Ezra Edelman is just clearly a very smart individual. He asks good questions. He's a gifted interviewer. He structured each piece in a very intricate way. I mean, this is really as good a documentary film as you're going to see. And if you can tell this in the first 10 minutes, you know, if you're hesitant about watching it, just start it and you'll be pulled into it.
All right, let's hear a little clip.
O.J. went to USC in 1967. So he's plucked out of the black community, out of black consciousness, and he's submerged in an all-white university. And I say this, and I don't say it facetiously, but he is seduced by white society.
You saw it too, Anne.
I did, and to Kenny's point, I was preparing to talk about it and had all these episodes, and I thought, well, I'll watch the first couple just so I was a little bit on deadline. I thought, I'll watch the first couple just so I'm, you know, cognizant of it. And to Kenny's point, I sat and watched the whole thing. I could barely leave my chair. I mean, it's just that well constructed and riveting. And in particular, that USC material. I mean, I really didn't know very much about the culture of Los Angeles in the 60s. And the archival research that Ezra Edelman and his team have done, I mean, just finding they tell the story visually so beautifully. And again, the nuances that he's able to tease out are just, it's remarkable.
Is it available online?
Oh, sure. Yeah. I think by this time it should be available on Netflix. I don't want to speak out of turn, but people should look for it on Netflix.
Tony, is it available? Do you know?
I think that it is, yes.
Yeah.
Right. You know, we get our special screener, so we don't know what
that's right.
I mean, there are so many films out there, Fantastic Beasts. I think it's Moana, Disney film. But The Edge of 17, talk about that very quickly.
Yes, this was a charmer that kind of came out of left field this year. It's a coming-of-age teenage movie, kind of in that history of the John Hughes movies, with a wonderful performance by Hailee Steinfeld, who came to our attention in True Grit. And I think really this is the best role she's had since that movie. It's about this kind of spiky, contrary, not very likable adolescent girl finding her way. And it just turns out to be a really charming, funny, observant movie.
All right. So the message of this program, enjoy yourselves at the movies this year. Before the year is out, after the year is over, enjoy the movies. Anne Hornaday, A.O., Tony Scott, and Kenneth Turan, thank you all so much.
Thank you.
And thank you.
Thanks
thank you,
all
Diane.
For listening. I'm Diane Rehm.
The Diane Rehm Show is produced by Sandra Baker, Denise Couture, Rebecca Kaufman, Lisa Dunn, Alexandra Boti, Danielle Knight, Erica R. Hendry, and Allison Brody. The engineer is Alex Drewenskus. Cliff Gallagher answers the phones. Visit drshow.org for audio archives, transcripts, and podcasts. Our email address is drshow@wamu.org. And we're on Facebook and Twitter. This program comes to you from American University in Washington. This is NPR.